Before we go into any more explanation, anyone has any particular questions on this chapter, why we'd be glad to entertain them before we get in any deeper.
What does the scarlet color of the beast represent?
All right, what's the scarlet represent? We have a good scriptural basis for this.
For your
sin, that's right. So this apparently would be a sinful beast also. And that too, you notice, is shown here as an unclean animal. Brother Harry drew the, more or less, the snout of a warthog or something that they call it. Wild boar, I guess it is. But it is a sinful, unclean animal. In this respect, it's something like the great red dragon, which was also a sinful animal. In this respect, it has two similarities to the dragon. It is red, and it also has seven heads. But that's where the similarities end. So, Stuart, did you have any thoughts?
No, I was just wondering.
Any other questions?
I was also wondering what the difference is between red and scarlet.
Well, who knows the difference between red and scarlet?
Scarlet is a bright
red. Yes, I think that's the answer, Sister Knight. Scarlet is a deeper hue, although red, scarlet is red. But it's just a specific type of red. In other words, red could be any variation. It could be light, dark, or indifferent. But scarlet gives you more or less the particular type of red that it is, of the real deep red, bright.
Brother
Kenneth?
I'd like to ask Brother Harry to sing as an artist. Do they consider scarlet red? The point I have in mind, any brother made quite a point to this, being scarlet being red, and that it's communism. Actually, it's not red. I think there might be a distinction between the scarlet.
Well, I don't know if I don't remember offhand what the Greek is. Harry, did he get your question?
He's talking in the visual.
Oh, well, we can't very well bother him now. But that's something we can check into. It doesn't use the same word as it does for the dragon. I mean, that it helps us to not confuse the two animals.
Mm-hmm.
Little Charles.
In the diagon, it uses the word scarlet in the interlinear.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember looking up the word scarlet, and I recall it, it's the bright red. Whether in the Greek, I'm not sure offhand whether that would be supported, but I'm sure that the diglot would give me a pretty fair discussion of it.
Brother Dean, what does the diglot say about 12:3 of Revelation? The red dragon. Is it called red or scarlet?
In that verse it says fiery red. A dragon great fiery red.
Which would be a lighter fire as an orangey color, more or less, wouldn't it? I mean, you think of a fiery red as being a little lighter hue.
Different shades of red. It's red, a garnet, and blue. Those are red.
Yes, that's right.
I thought about
garnet.
Not blue or yellow.
Brother, in orange, red. Unfortunately, red with an orange.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be more like my definition of the fiery red. It would have an orange flavor, and the fiery red would be a real red. Well, anyway, it's a sinful beast. I think we can agree on that. It's very readily. Any other questions?
Does all the clothes on the woman mean anything? The dress and all
Well, I think so. All of the details are given to portray her as a very wealthy woman, and it pictures her in another part of Revelation as sitting a queen, and there's your purple color, which was a regal color, and she was decked with gold, precious stones, and having a golden cup in her hand. All these things we believe are symbolic, emblematic of the scriptures and the precious things in the scriptures, the divine things that she had access to, even though the cup which she held, she had the outside of it golden, all right, but inside was a lot of bad things. But I think the clothing generally would describe her as a queen. A regal woman. Any other questions thus far? Well, if not, we'll go on. It's just a matter, I think, if we get into it a little more, we'll become a little plainer. It's just that we have so many details to absorb that it seems confusing, but I'm sure if you went over this a few times, it becomes easier each time. All right, now we'll start in with the 12th verse, even though we did read that, and read on a little bit. 12, well, to the end of the chapter. Let's read it all. Who has a good, loud voice? Brother Kenneth, do you want to read that, please? Yeah, 12 to the end.
And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, which received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples, and multitudes, and nations, and tongues. And the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and make her desolate, and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree, and give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth.
Now, you see, what the Revelator has done up to this point, he's taken us through history. He started back in Constantine's time. He showed us the seven great emperors who ruled in seven successive stages, and he showed us the seven empires that these kings or emperors made. And he finally comes to the end of that. He comes to the end of the seventh head, or the seventh king and the seventh head, which means that those emperors and those empires are all gone now. So we'll just rest them for a minute. We have, let's forget about the seven kings and the seven heads now, because that's all past history. We're interested in now in 10 kings, and we're interested in this wild beast, this scarlet-colored beast that comes up out of the abyss. that is the eighth. In other words, it's the form of government that comes after the seven heads and seven kings are off the scene, which is the now in prophecy. And that's the part, really, that all of this history was given for. As detailed as it is, it was given so that we can charter our course as to where we are on the stream of time. If we are correct in our understanding, it means that the seven heads and the seven kings are past history. We're living in the time in which the scarlet-colored beast, this beast, that was not the people's form of government, in which the common people were a force and power in the earth, and when that form of government should be rising up upon the European picture. And I think that is what is happening in Europe today. Now, going on with this story, after he tells us about these seven great kings, then he starts talking about small things. He starts talking about small kings, ten kings. Now, these ten kings are somewhat different from the other kings, the other horns that we have seen. He says that the ten horns that you saw on this beast, that is, these ten horns that you saw on this beast, what about these ten horns? Yeah, the ten kings. Well, that's good. We know what they are now. We know that these ten horns here are really ten kings. But what about these four kings?
They have no kingdom.
But the story isn't that bad for them because they receive grant of a kingdom. Isn't that what the account says? It says that they receive, how does that read?
Power, that's king. 1 hour.
1 hour with the beast. They receive power. Now, this is in the accusative case in the Greek. And it doesn't mean that they have power for the whole hour. It's not talking about the point of time. It's talking about the duration of time. It's talking about in this time. They receive a grant of a kingdom. Now, the words as yet, they have received no kingdoms as yet. The as yet, you'll notice, I think, in your King James Version, is italics, right? No?
No, it's not in the sign yet.
Well, I think in the diglot, then, it's supposed to be omitted. Somewhere it's omitted, and some rather than say that, well, that shouldn't be there. The as yet, pardon?
It is. There are brackets around the yet here in the diglot.
So we won't quarrel about whether the words as yet should be there, because we know from the subsequent account that that's true, that they have received no kingdoms as yet. That's really what it means. Because they later receive a kingdom. And when they receive their kingdom, they give their power and their strength unto who? Unto the beast. So in other words, if they have received no kingdoms, how could they give their kingdom to the beast? They must finally receive a kingdom. That's the thought. These ten kings, or ten horns as they're portrayed in the picture, we must think of them as ten kings that are going to arise. And we believe in the European picture, these ten kings, they have God-given grant to receive power with a people's form of government. That's what the account said. They receive power as kings, or during that hour, they receive power with the beast. God doesn't give them any other privilege. He gives them this privilege for a particular purpose. He started out to tell us about the judgment of this woman. That's what we're really interested in. And he's using these ten kings and this unclean beast, which the woman has been riding, even though the beast has been in a dormant condition. The people have been supporting the papacy, but they have had no voice in government down throughout the Roman period of history. He's using these ten kings and the beast to destroy the woman. That's really the whole point and substance of the lesson of the 17th chapter of Revelation. And all of this is merely a pinpointing of time so that you and I can read the details and approximate the period of time we're in and when the exact judgment of this woman is to be consummated. Now you notice it says that this woman, by the way, where does she sit? She sits in two places in this 17th chapter of Revelation. She sits, yes, it says the waters which thou sawest are the peoples and nations and tongue where the whore sitteth. So she sits on the waters, the people of Europe. All right. She sits there. What else? Where else does she sit? Yeah, she sits on the scarlet-colored beast, but where does she sit on the beast? Yes, it says the seven heads are seven kingdoms upon which the woman sits. So she sat on the head of the beast. That's sitting on the beast. Maybe the horns wouldn't be so comfortable. But she had a nice soft throne, a watery throne, and she sat on all seven of those heads. During this, in other words, this woman shrewdly kept her authority, her queenly authority, all during the Roman Empire. And while this poor form of people's government was voiceless and dormant during the Empire of Rome, the woman was sitting on these people and their form of government, which really didn't exist, it was dormant. It only existed in from the standpoint of a principle within the hearts of the people that they should one day rise up and have their way. Now, this is all centered around a war. And there are two wars mentioned in Revelation, one in the 19th chapter of Revelation, which we'll get into, and one in the 17th chapter of Revelation. But we don't believe they're two separate wars. They're the same war. They both instances mention the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. In this instance, we're told that when this war takes place, when these ten horns and the beast, or when these ten horns, does it say and the beast? Let's see. Oh, it just says these ten horns, or these ten kings shall make war with the land. These ten kings are going to make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and what else?
And they that are with him.
And what else?
Called, chosen, and faithful.
Called, chosen, and faithful. That, again, is a beautiful point for us to absorb. At the time that this war takes place, they that are with him, called, chosen, and additionally considered faithful. Many are called, few are chosen, and fewer still are faithful. But when this war takes place, they are, all the church are called, chosen, meaning here the crowns are all portions, and faithful. That's when this war takes place. Now, to try to put it into the past, the generality, in a sense, it's all right. I think generally we sometimes can apply scriptures generally. In a sense, there has been opposition to the incoming kingdom and so on. And from that standpoint, we may think of the kings as making war on the land. But see, these kings, these ten kings, as we see it, haven't really received their kingdoms yet. They haven't really, in Europe, completely subscribed to a people's form of government, whether it be socialism or communism or whatever the name happens to be when it emerges. We don't want to quibble over words. It's got to be, in the final analysis, it's got to be a government that the people, the common people, the poor people, have a voice in, because that's what they're granted for. They weren't given power for any other purpose. These ten kings were given power with the beast. what the this beast here, the scarlet colored beast, which is not the papacy. I mean, this scarlet colored beast has been repeatedly by Bible students been confused with the leopard like beast. But it's not the leopard like beast, it's a different beast. Because we'll prove that as we get on here in our study. You know, it would be queer anyway for the papacy. If this scarlet-colored beast is the papacy, why would it want to make war with a woman and eat her? Papacy represents Catholicism as a government here on earth. And additionally, we read in the 16th chapter of Revelation, we want to read that again. Somebody read it, please. Sixteenth verse.
And the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire.
Now, in your Bibles, if you have a pencil, it says, the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast. Change that word upon to hand. Now, we have good authority for that because the Griffbach's Recension, the Sinaitic Manuscript, the Diglot, the English Revised, the American Standard Revised, the Revised Standard Version, Rotherham, Moffat, Weymouth, Vatican Manuscript, 1160, Alexandrian Manuscript, Codex Vaticanus, and Codex Ephraimic Prescriptus. All of them support this thought of the 10 horns and the beast eating the woman. And that's really what this whole chapter is about. It's the judgment of this woman, the time when the King of Kings and Lord of Lords is going to destroy this abominable woman from off the face of the earth.
But isn't that the same thing? The 10 horns and the beast, aren't they one and the same? Are they the
people's one girl? Well, the 10 horns are the king. And the beast represents the people's form of government. In other words, you think of the king as individual, and the beast as a form of government. Just like in the other picture where we had seven heads and seven kings. The seven kings represent individuals. The head represented government over which these individuals ruled. Any further questions? Now, this is a critical time in history. And understanding this, if the theory is correct, and that's how we'll know how a theory is correct, that's the way you can tell a true prophet from a false one. It's the thing that he says comes to pass, and you know it's true. Well, we're not pretending to be prophets, but it is a theory. Now, a theory is not necessarily wrong. It can be a true theory. And what we have presented tonight is such a theory. We have been watching the developments in Europe. If our understanding is correct, we will never again see one man rule Europe. That's what this means. There were only seven kings. There were only seven emperors. That day is no more. Past. After these seven emperors pass off the scene, the universal wars of the Roman Empire are gone. Then, when the beast comes up out of the abyss, it's going to emerge with 10 kings. 10 kings, 10 men, are going to arise on the scene, and they're going to say, well, our power is with the people. Let's appeal to the poor people, to the common people, to the masses. Let's give them a voice in government. And those kings that do that, the Lord assures them success up to a point. Because they have the power to do that. They have power 1 hour, or during this hour, during this God-given grant of time, to receive a kingdom with the beast, with no other form of government. And it's got to be the 10 kings. That's what the scripture says. It's not going to be one king. It's got to be with the 10. Now, what we want to do, too, is to parallel these wars. We can trace where we are by proper parallelization. Let this turn to the 19th chapter. We, of course, can't... this will come to a later study. We haven't really finished our discussion of the leopard-like beast. We only more or less discussed the introduction to it, and later we'll get into the final end and destruction of it. But we believe these two wars, the one mentioned in the 17th chapter and then the 19th chapter, are the same war against the same king, kings and lord of wars, only they're shown from different standpoints. You notice we said the 17th chapter was a complete story. It tells you everything it started out to tell you right in the one chapter. Whereas chapter 13, that introduced the leopard-like beast to us, doesn't finish the destruction of the beast, or the leopard-like beast, until Revelation, the 19th chapter. It goes on through chapter and chapter and chapter until finally it comes to the point where you see the dragon destroyed and the leopard-like beast destroyed. And the 19th chapter is finally where the hosts of sin are all destroyed, and that takes in the papacy, that takes in the false prophets, and that takes in the kings of the earth and their armies, which are really representative of the dragon. But in this 11th chapter, you notice the setting, starting in the 11th verse. It's the King of Kings who is coming to make war. He doesn't come like at his first advent without a crown, riding upon a ass, meek and lowly. Behold, your king cometh unto you, meek and lowly, riding on an ass. In this chapter, 11th verse, who'll read it? 11th and 12th verses. Rob, do you have it there, please?
And I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse. And he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he doth judge and make war. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns, and he had a name written that no man knew but he himself.
Yes, now you see here, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, is an aggressor. He comes on a white horse, which represents doctrine, pure doctrine, but also a white horse was usually the animal of war, and it was often the animal of prince or king. And this time he has on his head many crowns. He didn't come like at the first advent without any crown still on. The only crown he had was the crown of thorns. And he has a name written that no man knoweth except he himself, so on. Well, we are familiar with that part. And it's all tied in with the treading of the winepress here in the 15th verse. Well, maybe we'd better read it just to correlate the wars. Well, somebody read on to the 16th verse. Alfred, do you have it there, please?
13?
Yes, please.
And he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name was called the Word of God. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth goes his sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he had on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords.
Yes. And of course, then he, if you remember the rest of this count, the Greek conqueror, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he's confident of victory. He comes in righteousness to make war. That's his very purpose. To make war with this beast. And we'll show you a picture of this war here. This is the scene portrayed in the 19th chapter. Opposing him on the opposite side, peppered like beets. Kings of the earth and their armies, their representation of the dragon, and with him the false prophet, in fact, the Church of England and Ireland, and also the Federation of Churches. There's the end of your false church system. Now, you see the parallel between this war and that in the 17th chapter of Revelation. They're taken from different standpoints. The 17th chapter shows the details of how the Lord maneuvers world events so that he can destroy the woman. And the 17th chapter of Revelation, we're told how the Lord puts it into their hearts, the hearts of these 10 kings and the beasts, to hate the woman, to destroy her as a church system. Here we see the papacy and the governments of earth being destroyed as governments in the earth. The 17th chapter shows the destruction of a false church. This shows the destruction of false government exercising power in the earth. This is the same picture, but from different standpoints, that's all. There are not two such wars, but they're the same war and the same thing again. Well, now, are there any questions up to this point? Who asked the question?
I was wondering whether in this 1990, whether these kings of the earth are the same as the kings, the 10 kings in the 17th. I saw the beasts and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together.
Yes. I think they are the same kings. They're the only kings that exist at that time, I mean, in the Roman Empire, and that's particularly what this vision is concerned with. I mean, other nations will be involved in this matter by extension, but the picture of Revelation is concerned basically with what takes place in the Roman Empire.
And he hath on his
vesture
and on his side. What would be the... That's a funny place for a name, isn't it?
Yes. Well, of course, I don't know just what the significance there, except that it's written doubly on his thigh. Just the thigh would be where... Well, no, his sword isn't on his thigh. It comes out of his mouth. The sword of his mouth, so I don't know what the thigh would signify.
Was there some connection with Jacob with the thigh? Did he put his hand on his thigh?
Yes, he shriveled it up. An angel did, and he was laying thereafter. I don't know if anyone has a thought, but I would be glad to consider it. Of course, basically, I know we could go over each little point in considerable detail. That would take ever so long, but really the basis of this study is to get an overall concept, even though we welcome all the detail we can absorb. But that's why we haven't gone into every particular detail, every verse and every word to analyze it, because if we do that, I'm afraid that we won't be able to see the overall concept. At this particular time, we're really trying to get.
Let's see.
Sister Helena.
In the 14th verse of the 19th chapter, it mentions there, and the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. Would that correspond with the verse in 14 which states, if there are they that are with him are called and chosen faithful?
Yes, it is my thought. And others too, I know, feel the same way. That this war takes place when the saints are called, chosen, and faithful. And in this case, we see the armies which are in heaven, which is not the Lord's great army, but it's a holy army that is clothed in white. And Revelation tells us specifically that this white linen that it's talking about in Revelation is to the righteousness of the saints, which is not so much the robe of Christ's righteousness in this particular sense, but it represents the fact that God has judged them righteous as new creatures in Christ's kingdom.
Are these called children faithful? They correspond to are those
that are killed in the forest? Yes, I think so. I think that there's where all of this begins to tie in. You see, if we parallel these wars, then we see that naturally the church would have to be complete. The sealing work would have to be done, and that would fulfill the seventh chapter of Revelation, where the four winds of heaven were held back until the saints were sealed in their forehead. And actually, it's the pouring out of the seventh vial, which was upon the air, which was the power of the air, the spiritual ruling powers of the air. It's the seventh plague that's poured out, we believe, that finishes Babylon. And it finishes all these opposing forces of the Lord. That's where the great power of spiritual control is let loose and destroyed by the conquering Lord and King. In other words, I think it all ties in. There's other tie-ins which we'll get into. We're going to have to go back and pick up threads of thought from the 13th chapter on, but we purposely wanted to get over these five beasts, basically, and then we'll follow the other beasts in detail up until the time that they are destroyed.
Brother Gene?
Brother,
may I just suggest a couple of scriptures that I was thinking about in connection with this 19th chapter? It's Micah 4:13 and Micah 5:1.
If you have them, read them, please, sir.
Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thine horn iron, and I will make thy hoof brass, and thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto the Lord, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. Now gather thyself in troops, O daughter of troops. He hath laid siege against us. They shall smite the judge of Israel with a rod upon the cheek. It seems to me that those verses would fit in with this war in the 19th chapter of Revelation. Although the last statement in the first verse of chapter 5 might very well refer to the crucifixion of Jesus. It took him bruised his heel. Referring back to that at the time of his bruising the serpent's head.
Thank you. Well, that's a good thought. I just, while I think of it, I have just a few words here from Brother Russell in the fourth volume, page 17, where Brother Russell, he often repeats it, and sometimes easy to forget, but Brother Russell always identified the treading of a winepress as the very last thing in the harvest. That's the last feature of the harvest. He says, on page 17, the treading of a winepress is the last feature of the harvest work. The reaping and gathering is all done first. So the treading of the winepress with the wrath of God into which the vine of the earth, the false vine, which has misappropriated the name Christian and Christ's kingdom, is cast when it is iniquitous, when its iniquitous clusters are fully ripe, represents the last work of this eventful harvest period. Now notice it's harvest period, and it's the Lord's harvest. And it's the angels, the Lord's angels, that are used in harvest. It pictures to our minds the last feature of the great time of trouble which shall involve all nations and of which we are so abundantly forewarned in the Scriptures. Now that was Brother Russell's thought. Now he says that first the true harvest is all reaped. Then the harvest of the vine of the earth takes place. So we've had the treading of the wine press by Bible students all around through this time, 7th volume particularly. They went out and gather the clusters of the wine of the earth and cast them into the wheat, great wine press with the wrath of God and so on. But you see, it was predicated on the idea that the harvest was all over and this was just the gathering of the wine of the earth and it's all done. See, they were ready for the destruction feature. But actually, we know that back there and up till now, the saints haven't all been called, chosen, and faithful. And the gathering of the true harvest hasn't been completed. So this was Brother Russell's thought. So when in the 19th chapter, when he speaks about the treading of the winepress by the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he's not talking about a general period all through this harvest, but he's talking about the time after the true harvest has been gathered in which the Lord is finishing up the last part of the harvest, that is, gathering the clusters of this false vine of the earth and destroying it. There's another parallel of this war. That's the same thing from a different picture. Destruction of the wine, the grapes of the vine, this false vine, is the same thing as the war, showing different aspects. Any further questions on this matter?
Somewhere in the Old Testament, it speaks of the treader of grapes, which is where the farmer overtakes the reaper.
And the treader of grapes?
The treader of grapes, who is
seed.
Does this treading of grapes there tie in with his wine press picture?
I think so. I think this time of destruction will overtake the reapers. And he that soweth, what is it, seed? Well, the thought there I would get, simply tying this in with Revelation, is that this time of trouble finishes the harvest work and the sowing work. It's in this, in other words, the saints are be sowing up until the time that their end comes, and they'll be harvesting this vine of the earth, not the true harvest, but they'll be harvesting the vine of the earth as a part of their last work and commission when they're overtaken. The saints, this is corroborated in the 25th chapter of Matthew, the 13th chapter of Matthew, I forgot, I think it's the 13th for the parable of the wheat and tares. Yeah, the 13th. There the angels, they gather the wheat into the barn, and they also gather the tares in bundles, and they cast them into the fire to be burned. Who are the angels? Are there a different set of angels that do the gathering in one sense? Another set of angels that cast them into the fire?
Reapers are the angels.
Reapers are the angels. And we believe that the saints will have a work to do up until the last part. In other words, the saints are involved in this war. Up till this time, the saints have always been losing the battle against the Antichrist. Not from the standpoint that they lost out on the heavenly hope. We know that they were victorious in death, but they were never able to completely destroy the systems of sin, even though in the Reformation, ones like Luther, some of the saints did a pretty good job of making war with that beast. This great Goliath that they put forth and said, who is able to make war with it? Well, some of the saints do a bad job, even though they lost out in the end, the beast still survived. But when the King of Kings begins to wield his sword, that's the end of all these beasts.
Gene?
Sure.
How do we reconcile the fact that the saints are with him, in that work, with Isaiah 63:3? I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me.
All right. As the treader of grapes, that would represent our Lord. He says that he does it alone. And the people, there was none with him. And Brother Russell says in the fourth volume, to no human generalship can the coming victory for truth and righteousness be ascribed. The Lord assumes full responsibility for this time of trouble. It's not the communists, it's not anybody else, but the Lord, as the King of Kings, assumes the complete responsibility for the destruction of these systems of sin. And the people, while he has a great army with them, they receive no credit for the work that they do. They are not considered as workmen of the Lord, even though he has a tremendous army that he uses to fulfill his will. But they get none of the credit because they are not with him. Do you have a thought on that, Stuart?
I think that fits very well. The saints clearly will be proved faithful, at least by the time this happens. So possible the view may not yet have been actually changed at the beginning of it. But they certainly have a share in breaking the nations to pieces like a potter's vessel. That's clear in Revelation. So, but they are acting at one with Jesus. So as their general, he is the one that's doing it. Just as Gideon put the Midianites to flight, even though he had 300 working with him.
Yes, and the interesting thing about this war is we're not to think of it as being something apart from the Lord's word, because he smites the nations with a sword that proceeds out of his mouth. In other words, the papacy, they were using every means. They were using every possible means they could, deception and everything. But here the Lord, with the sword of his mouth, the truth, which is sharper than any two-edged sword, uses the truth to destroy the systems of sin. And he uses his saints, too, in the pouring out of these plagues, which we'll get into in the 16th chapter, which it all begins to tie in as we get into this thing a little more in detail. Well, I think we've pretty well covered the substance in this chapter. The 17th chapter, the story is complete. We started out by John taking us into the wilderness of separation and so on, and he shows us this judgment of the great whore. And we believe the angel here that shows John this is probably the angel of the second volume, chapter 9 on the man of sin. There is where Brother Russell shows us the judgment of the great whore. And in this same chapter, he tells us who the scarlet-colored beast is. He says it represents the Roman people. And we add the word government because the beast always represents the government. So in this same chapter, we believe the angel that showed us this would be the message that we have in the second volume on the man of sin. And then from there, we of course, saw the history of the past so that we could pinpoint where we are on the stream of time. And having done that, we see what yet remains. There are 10 kings that are yet to emerge. There may be some on the scene already, we don't know, that are going to subscribe to a people's form of government. And when they do, when that all materializes, then we'll know exactly where our deliverance is, when it shall be, because when we see these 10 kings subscribing to a people's form of government, we'll know that the strategic hour is near for the war to begin. They're going to make war on the land, and they'll lose. And the land, how are they going to lose the war? Well, the Lord puts it into their hearts. He changes their direction. They started out to destroy him and his followers, and he changes their direction, and he puts it into their hearts to hate the woman and to destroy her, to eat her. On, and they do. And the 10 horns and the beast together devour this woman. And that beast will say again so that no one will confuse it with the papacy. The papacy represents the Roman people's form of government, that is, of the common poor people.
Brother Gene?
Brother Charles?
May I ask this question? Do we feel that it will be the church who is on this side of the veil, who are the called and chosen and faithful, who will be associated with the Lord in this work here at the conclusion when Babylon would finally be destroyed?
Well, I think so. I think that all of Revelation, up to the 19th chapter particularly, is given to show to the saints the things which must speedily be done, and it involves the saints. That's why it's shown to them. I mean, if it was all to be done in heaven, why should the Lord go to such great details to manifest all of this to us now? Always with a revelation, there comes a responsibility associated with it. The whole message that we received in the harvest was in the mouth sweet, but in the stomach it was bitter. And that will be true, I think, of this revelation. Understanding it, as we come to understand it more, we'll find that it also will have a bitterness in the stomach. It's going to mean making our stand for the Lord and for the truth, and it's going to mean wielding this sword of the Spirit in a way perhaps which many feel is not Christian-like to do. That is, in a warfare against those who oppose the truth and who have opposed it down through the age, these great systems of sin which the Lord said he was going to destroy with the spirit of his mouth.
Well, Brother King, in regard to Brother Charles' question, I'm thinking here again about that 14th verse that I had mentioned earlier. And specifically, there says, "And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean," which you yourself suggested it was the righteousness of the saints themselves. And they would be with the Lord, they would be beyond the veil when that work is being done. I'm a little confused in that point.
Well, read on now to the 19th verse.
"And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army."
What happened to the army? Well, you notice it started off, it says that there were armies in heaven. Now, this is not the heavens of heavens, the real heavens. This is the heavens of earth. The saints, as far as I'm concerned, they don't go to heaven when they die. They stay right here for 1,000 years. The heavens of earth. But we shall all be caught up with the Lord in the air. But be that as it may, I don't want to involve any more theology than necessary. The heavens here are the heavens of revelation. They're the powers of spiritual control. And the saints are there. It represents them at a time in which the Lord has assumed complete regal authority in the spiritual heavens, and he'll not tolerate any counterfeit power in his domain. He is the ruler. He is the King of Kings in the heavens. And like what the man-child did to the dragon, he cast them out. So that's what the King of Kings is doing. He's throwing out of office and out of power all opposing powers that he does not recognize. And that's what it means when they're with him in heaven. Now, that's true. Some of the saints are in glory. But it says when the war takes place, it's an army. Now, in order for there to be armies, what would it have to be anyway?
More than one.
It has to be at least in two parts, otherwise you couldn't say that the Lord had armies. And these armies, he's not talking about anybody. He's talking about armies that are in white. So that would rule out the Lord's great army. They're not even in this picture, particularly. He's talking about armies in white. So would it not seem, and Brother Russell, I think, suggested, ought to, that the armies being in the plural would suggest that some of the saints are on this side of the veil and some are on the other side of the veil. But when the beast makes war, they make war against the Lamb by making war against the saints that are still on this side of the veil. They make war against his army, singular. I don't know if that throws any light on the subject.
It couldn't be, Brother Jean said it, that by the time you get to the 19th verse, they're all glorified.
Well, that would be a thought.
Brother Jean.
Brother Kenneth.
I think the parable of the wheat and tares includes that. And that after the wheat, the reaping of the wheat, same angels bind the tares into bundles and cast them into the fire to be burned. So that these angels, these who were the reapers of the wheat, the church, are still on the scene, even after the collection of the church is completed. And they're sharing in this work in the final destruction of the bundles and the individual tares of nominal Christians. So that would seem to indicate that during this war, the saints, some saints will still be this side of the veil sharing in that war, very actively engaged in that war. So Russell's article on the harvest in 1915 very definitely brings out the plot that these angels will cast the tares into the fire so that he's burned, that they represent the church this side of the veil, and it's after the 144,000 have completely been perfected.
Well, of course, this matter could be debated. I know there is a feeling that perhaps the saints on this side of the veil don't amount to much, and therefore they wouldn't be used in any prominent way. But actually, everything that we have in Revelation is given to the saints. The book was given to show them the things which must speedily be done. And it was with the view of preparing them for their responsibilities in the war. Now, there are other scriptures. This would be a study in itself. I mean, to take all the facts and circumstances, and the one that Brother Kenneth mentioned, and there's Ezekiel that ties in this. But briefly, we're going to get into this more in the 16th chapter of Revelation. There we see how the Lord makes his war. He pours out vials full of the wrath of God upon the earth, one after another. And these vials, of course, we haven't gone into this to establish as to when they are poured out, but we think that we can, taking all of Brother Russell's writings, establish pretty much the time in which they will be poured out. These vials represent the Lord's method of making war. And he uses basic truths that we have to do it. The only thing the Lord has to do is to allow his truth to get sufficient coverage and the proper message given at the right time to accomplish his work. And that's what makes it so glorious, of how the Lord can accomplish the work by using a few. He doesn't have to take just the spiritual army in heaven to make a crushing defeat on Satan. The beautiful part of this is that the Lord, who is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, uses the army on this side of the veil to deal the crushing blow to battle. And there's where the saints gain the victory. They destroy. You see, up to this point, the beast has been crushing the saints. But at this particular point, when the Lord assumes full regal authority in the heavens, the tide of battle is the other way. He allows his remaining saints to accomplish that work. Now, that matter will have to be established a little more in detail, but I think as we go over it, we hope to develop a little more proof that the saints will be used, and we feel that's one of the basic reasons for understanding this revelation, is for our part in such a work. But do you have any thought on that, Brother Stewart?
No, I was just asking for ideas.
Well, if not, I think we're a little overdue tonight. Started a little late, and this is perhaps the most difficult portion, the most detailed anyway, so we'll just arise.